Hi everyone, I'm Heather Sorensen. Welcome to my home. I'm sitting in what I call the church room, and I know that you guys can't really see it, but it's got an old church pew, it's got an old piano, some stained glass windows, part of my hymnal collection, those kinds of a thing. And so I thought, what an appropriate room to do a session on church choirs, right? So thanks for coming to my session. If it feels a little bit weird to be watching a conference online, well, it feels a little weird on my end too. I'm gonna do my best to be engaging and conversational with just me and the camera. And maybe my dog will walk through. She probably wonders why her mom is talking to herself today. I hope that you guys are staying safe and healthy during these very unusual times in our history. Of course, most musicians are unemployed. We have been unemployed. We will be unemployed for quite some time. But God has taken care of me very well. God took great care of me before this pandemic, and that did not change. And so I have no complaints. The only complaint I have is that I have serious COVID hair, y'all, and I'm sorry about that. I have not seen the inside of a salon since February. So I apologize for the COVID hair. I actually took a pair of scissors to it the other day. You know, I thought, how hard can it be to cut your own hair? Turns out very hard. And so there are parts of my hair that the camera will not show you today because it's that bad. This session today was birthed a couple years ago in my career, in my ministry. I do a lot of traveling. I'm on the road a lot. I think last year I was on the road for 30 different events, from conferences to concerts, church composer weekends, that kind of a thing. And so I work with church choirs and volunteer church choirs all the time. And I usually say, you know, every choir is different, but every choir is the same. And that's true. Regardless of how big your choir is, how much talent your choir has, how many resources you have as a choir, I have noticed that choirs in general have the same issues. They trip up over the same things. They've got the same obstacles. And so I have created a session based on those things that I have seen as weaknesses in church choirs. So that's kind of shaped and been the backbone of this session. Most choir directors that I meet wish that they had more tenors. I think everybody wishes that. It's like, God, did you not make enough tenors? I don't know. But they wish that they had more tenors, or they wish that they had a soprano who could sing a higher note, or they wish that they had more people in their choir. You know, if we could just get to the 50 mark, or if we could just get to the 75 mark, or, you know, for our Christmas cantata, wouldn't it be great if we could just get to that 100 mark? That would make us such a better choir. And I know some of you out there are watching and thinking, if we could just get to 12 people on a good Sunday, we would be really happy. And that's okay. You know, none of this is about numbers, but we all have a wish list of things that we want for our choir. You know, if our tone were just better, if my choir only knew how to read music better, if only, if only, if only. These are good things. These are not bad things. We should want our choir to be better. We should want to be more effective in our ministry. But sometimes there is just not another tenor in the church. You know, sometimes everyone who can sing is already in the choir. Sometimes you just don't have any more resources to use. And so today I want to give you a list of a few guaranteed sure things that will make your choir immediately better if they do them. And by the way, I never guarantee anything. My personality always gives disclaimers for everything. My motto is kind of under promise, over deliver. But I feel pretty confident in saying that I can guarantee that you will have a transformed choir and you will increase your effectiveness as a choir if you will just do these few things. I've got 8 different things, and they require no new singers or no additional talent. I will tell you that these 8 points, none of them are flashy. None of them are like razzle dazzle or earth shattering. You've probably heard these things before, but choirs are not doing them. I know, because I work with so many choirs, and church choirs especially are not doing these eight things. And we've all heard the phrase leaving money on the table. And so by church choirs not doing these things, we're practically leaving money on the table. We're leaving effectiveness on the table. And if this is our ministry and if this is our service to God, why would we want to be ineffective? Okay, so here's number one. I know you all have never heard this before. And choir directors, I know you've never said this before. Look up. And I think I just heard a collective amen from all of the choir directors across America. Most choirs have what I call the choir disease, meaning that no matter how well they know their music, their heads are almost always down. And it's not because they don't know their music very well. If that's the case, if they don't know their music very well, then that's another issue. You know, we have to think through, have we not given enough weeks to learn the music as a director? Are our choir members, is their attendance so irregular that they don't have time to learn the music? Are we as directors maybe not organizing our rehearsal time well enough? Those kinds of things. But I don't think that's really why heads are down in the choir. You know, we have the greatest message in the world to deliver, and every time our heads go down in choir, we break communication with our audience. And I understand that we're volunteer church choirs and that rehearsal time is so limited and it's so precious. And to expect our choirs to have memorized material every week, that's just really not practical. You know, there are some choirs who do that. They memorize every single anthem, and that's super impressive. But I think that for most of our choirs, that's just not reasonable, and I wouldn't expect that at all. However, like I said, I think our heads are down because we have lacked the discipline to make this a habit. And so, of course, the way that we correct this means that we need to make a habit of looking up. I know this can be done because a couple years ago, I put this to the test myself. I blocked out 8 weeks of time 2 years ago during the spring where I was just going to stay home, not travel, and I was going to work on projects, meet deadlines, commissions, that kind of a thing. And I decided, okay, since I'm home for 2 months, I'm going to make good use of this. And so I appointed myself some professional development. And I joined a choir. I've always been on the accompanist side or the composer side or the director side, but I've never really been on the singer side. So I called up the director. He's a fantastic director of one of the best church choirs in the region. And I said, "Hey, can I just join your choir for 8 weeks?" And he was so gracious. He said, "Absolutely, come on." And so I determined from that very first rehearsal, I was going to be the choir member that I beg every other choir member to be. I was going to go in there and I was going to communicate because I know how effective that is and I know how ineffective it is when a singer is looking down. So I get into the rehearsal, my first rehearsal. Of course, I'm sight reading everything. Everyone else around me has already worked through the music some, but that's okay. You know, like I said, I'm a decent sight reader. And we started singing and my head went down and I thought, oh, this is why everyone's head goes down, because it's so easy. So probably 25, 30 times in that first rehearsal, I just said, "Look up, Heather, look up, Heather, look up, Heather, look up, Heather." And I made it a habit. And so by the end of those 8 weeks, I remember I was singing in church one Sunday and I was having the time of my life. I was loving it. I loved the music. I was worshiping. And I opened my mouth to sing the next phrase. And I realized as my mouth was opening, I had no idea what that next phrase was because I hadn't looked at my page, at my music, in at least a page and a half. And in that moment, you know, I had that moment of fear of, oh no, you know, I'm on stage singing this. This is televised and I'm right in front of the camera. And it immediately changed over to joy that, hey, this can be done in a very short time period. I have created a habit of looking up because honestly, after working with all of these choirs over the past couple years, I didn't know if it could be done because I had nobody prove that it could be done, but it could be done, and I did it in a very short time. So this means that you, as the director, for the directors who are watching, You need to know your music and your cues well enough to do the same thing. You can't expect your choir members to look up if you are not looking up yourself. It is a rare occurrence for me to walk into a rehearsal situation or into a performance situation where I know my music so little that my head has to be down. And by the way, all of this is won in the rehearsals. Every battle on all of these points that I'm talking about, you have to do these in rehearsal. If you wait until you're in a performance situation, you've already lost the battle on these. So will this take extra prep time for you as the director? Yes. Will it be worth it? Absolutely. Like I said, every time your choir looks down, they break communication with their audience. I can just almost hear the mumbling under your breath right now as you're saying, Heather, I have said this to my choir until I am blue in the face and they are still not looking up. I know. So there's a couple things that I do in these situations. The first one is that I tell the choir, okay, you've got 30 seconds, 45 seconds, look at the first two pages or whatever, measure this to measure that and memorize it. At the end of those 30 or 45 seconds, I say, okay, now close your music, put it under your chair and let's sing now. And so every head is up and every eye is up on me. And this is really important because first of all, they realize, oh, I know the music better than I thought I did. And that's important because they are building confidence. If they don't build confidence in the rehearsal, they will never look up from their music in the performance or on a Sunday. They won't do it. They'll be too afraid of messing up. So it's really important to build their confidence in the rehearsal. Also, it builds trust between the choir and the director because as they're trying out their memory for the first time and they're a little shaky on it, they don't have confidence yet, they're relying on the director to give them everything, to mouth the words, to show them the dynamics through their hands, all of these things. So this really is a great tool in your rehearsals. For the extremely hard cases, every now and then you run across the choir, and this is so much easier for me to say when there's nobody here because nobody feels like I'm preaching directly at them, but every now and then you work with a choir that just refuses to look up. And there's always a grumpy old man in the back row that if you say look up, he's gonna look down. And you think, why are you even in choir? If this is your ministry, you know, take ownership of it. But in the cases where it's a real struggle to get your choirs to look up and you've worked on it and worked on it, and it's just not going anywhere. In those situations, you give the choir 2 weeks. You say, okay, choir, not this Sunday, but the next Sunday, we are going to sing this from memory. Of course, at this point, you've already rehearsed this for several weeks and your choir is going to hate it. Choir members, I'm very sorry. I know it's hard to do that and I know it eats into your personal time at home and it sounds like this is a punishment. I think you'll see in a few minutes that it's not. What happens when the choir sings it from memory in church is that they will give the performance of a lifetime. They communicate 100% better because 100% of them are looking up. They communicate, they sing better. They're better musicians because all of a sudden the director is able to give them all those musical nuance cues that he's never been able to give them before because nobody was looking at him. Or maybe he or she was giving those cues, but everybody missed them. So you're a better singer, you're a better communicator, you're a better musician. And your congregation might not know what it was, but they're going to leave saying, man, I got so much out of that choir anthem today. My second point goes hand in hand with the first one. The second point is come alive.
So
You must teach your choir to come alive because they won't naturally do it on their own. This is, I call this type two of the choir disease. Visual energy is as much part of your performance as right notes and right rhythms are. And I know that I called that a performance. I do realize that we don't perform for other believers on Sundays, but we perform for the King, right? And so it just makes sense that we prepare for it like a performance. So I just wanted you to know I use the word performance and I'm okay with that. I wanted to clarify that though. You know, some people in our choir are extroverts. They process emotion externally and it's very easy for them to emote. A lot of people in our choirs are introverts and we process emotions internally and we don't emote as much externally. Regardless of whether you are an introvert or an extrovert, we all seem to have the same problem here with emoting, with coming alive on stage. If you've ever studied personalities, if you've ever studied Myers-Briggs, I am an INFJ. INFJs are classic introverts. A lot of times people don't believe that, people who don't know me well, because they only see stage Heather, and I'm usually very alive and animated on stage. But really, I am an introvert, and I have worked so hard in my career, in my ministry, to emote, to come alive on stage. Because I know that if I am not emotive, if I'm not coming alive on stage, that I am diluting my message and I'm diluting my effectiveness. I believe that my ministry and my calling is important. I believe that because I think that God does not call us to things that are not important. And if my calling is important, then I want to make sure that I'm doing everything I can to be effective. I don't want to get in the way of what God's plan is for my ministry. So this means that this has to start with you as the director. You are going to lead your choir into coming alive in the rehearsals. Again, I'm going to say this over and over, all of these battles are won in the rehearsal. And you're going to hear the choir say back to you, oh, because they've said this to me, they've said, Heather, I promise when we get in front of people, we come alive then. And I say to that, baloney, because I've seen you come alive and you go from this much emoting to this much emoting. And honestly, when you factor in the distance of your congregation to that person in the back row, you have not changed your expression at all. So we really need to work on this. And like I said to the directors, it has to start with the director. You might think, well, Heather, I'm not an emotive person. I'm not an emotive director. Neither am I. And we work on these things. We become emotive on stage. And I will tell you, as an INFJ, if I can do this, anybody can. Even that grumpy bass on the back row. Anybody can do this if I can do this. Some people say, well, does that feel a little bit fake? Maybe. Especially at the beginning, if you've not made this a habit, if you've not disciplined yourself into this. Is it fake? It depends on what you believe in your heart. If you believe the words that you're singing, that's not fake. It is okay to train your face to reflect what's in your heart. A note to the directors, they will almost never outshine you in this area. And I'll give you a little example of this. I worked with children's choirs for years, and the first thing that I trained them to do was to never take their eyes off of me. I would make a little game out of it. I would walk around the room. I would almost hide behind a curtain, and they did everything they could to not take their eyes off of me because they didn't want to lose the $1 million that I had promised to them. So we had a lot of fun with it. But then the next thing I taught them was they need to exactly mirror whatever my face and my body language was telling them to do. And so we would practice this in rehearsal again, where if we were working on a scary song, my whole body language would change and my eyebrows would change. And I would stop them in rehearsal and say, oh, you guys aren't doing it the exact same way I am. Look how I'm doing it. And then they would copy that. And we had so much fun with that. When we got to the performances, you know, children's choir performances, we love them because we love the children. But honestly, sometimes, you know, the production value might not be up there. I can tell you, audiences loved these children's choir concert because the kids were so emotive and so energetic. Their body language was so into what they were singing. So that just goes to prove to you that this can be learned, it can be done, and I know you probably don't want to take it to that extent with a church choir, an adult church choir, but really they are watching you for your cues on that, and so you as the director need to come alive as well. Again, it starts in the rehearsal. It will never happen well if you just try to implement it on stage. So moving on to my third point. The best piece of advice I have ever heard in a church choir situation came from the director of that choir that I joined for 2 months. He was particularly frustrated with the group when one rehearsal. Apparently we kept messing up in the same places. Silly little mistakes. It wasn't overly difficult. We were just not paying attention. We were not focused. And apparently we had to keep re-going over the same thing the week before in the rehearsal because we weren't paying attention. And so he was quite upset and he said, "Choir, I'm going to ask this group of volunteers, every time you walk into this rehearsal room, you pick up the mantle of professionalism and you wear it." And I thought that is the best piece of advice I have ever heard for a church choir. Most rehearsal time in church choirs is relearning and going back over the same mistakes over and over and over again. And you can cut out about 80% of that, which, by the way, that's a made up number. I don't know. Maybe 70%. I was giving this session a while back and a director yelled out 95%. So anyways, you can cut out a big percentage of that just by your volunteers acting like professionals. That doesn't mean that we can't come to church choir and have fun and fellowship and laugh. I think that church choirs should do that. I think that we should have fun and we should enjoy each other's company. But I think we are cutting our effectiveness in half by not acting like professionals, by not taking this seriously, by not adding some disciplines in there that we can. And so when he said, pick up that mantle of professionalism, I thought, okay, I'm a professional musician. What things do I do as a pro that can apply to the church choir situation? So I've got a few things here. If every person were in their chair with their music in order, pencil in hand, 1 minute before the rehearsal starts, that's what a professional musician does. We never fly in by the seat of our pants without our music in order, not knowing where our pencil is. We just don't do that. Another thing, if every person in your choir self-policed themselves, marking their music at tricky spots before the director even says to pull out their pencil, that's what a professional does. And I have to go back again to this 8-week choir experience I had. In that very first rehearsal with the choir, this sounds like a weird word to use for this, but I was delighted to see that when I sat down in rehearsal, all of these volunteers around me had a pencil in hand already. They didn't have to dig through their folder. They didn't have to go to their cubbies. They had a pencil in hand. And as we were singing through music, anytime they missed something, just little, they maybe pronounced a word wrong, or they sang through a rest, or they had a rhythm just a little incorrect, they marked it in their music so that the director wouldn't have to say anything the next time through. That's what a professional musician does. And by the way, in the pro world, when the director says, okay, everybody stop and mark that, you better be pretty sure that we stop and mark that, because if we go around again and we miss it, we don't get hired again by those people. So these are things that professionals do. And I can't tell you, I know this is a little thing, but it's big. I can't tell you how many times I've walked in as the guest conductor for a choir and everybody's on good behavior when I walk in. And I say, pull out your pencils and mark that. The next time we go around, half of the choir still misses it. And sometimes if I've built up enough rapport with them, I say, okay, raise your hand if you had marked that before. And I'm horrified. These are the groups that are on their best behavior that only 40 or 50% of them marked it when I said, please mark that. This is something that's little, that costs nothing, no additional talent. It doesn't require any extra members. Everybody can do that. And so things like this we're leaving on the table. As a pro musician, you know, I said I'm a pretty darn good sight reader. And yet when I was in that choir for 8 weeks, every Wednesday night after rehearsal, I took my music home. And every Saturday night, I practiced my music for 20 to 30 minutes. Not so that I wouldn't make a mistake the next day. You know, I know how to read music well enough to do that. But because I wanted to be an effective ministry member in that choir, I wanted to know my music well enough to look up and to come alive. So do these things. If your ministry, if your choir ministry is worth you giving up 75 to 80 hours a year, then why not be effective? Why not pick up that mantle of professionalism and wear it every time you walk into rehearsal? Okay, so those are my heavy hitters. I've got a few more points to go, but if you would just do those three things, every person in your choir committed and disciplined themselves to do those three things, you would be a transformed choir. You will double your effectiveness. My fourth point, the fastest way to change how your choir sounds is to change the shape of their mouth. So many directors focus on trying to get them to mimic a sound. The problem with that is that we hear sounds differently in our head when we're singing than people do outside. And so it's almost like we're fighting a losing battle there. If you can get them to change the shape of their mouth, you will change their sound. Different songs and different styles use different sounds. And so train your choirs that on different sounds, on different songs, we're gonna change the shape of our mouth. And then when we go to this song over here, we're gonna change the shape of our mouth a little bit differently. If you're going for that very cathedral, more of a high churchy sound, sometimes we tell our choirs tall vowels and they're trying and it's still not giving us the same sound that we want. So tell them to tuck in the corners of their mouth like this a little bit and you're probably gonna get a better sound from them. Number five, again, this is something that I know that you have worked with your choirs on, but we're still not quite getting it. Blend. Church choirs have the hardest time blending, and this is something that directors, you have to insist upon. Ironically, the biggest culprits in this tend to be our choir members who maybe are a little bit more talented. They've got a little bit more musicality to offer. And so kind of as a public service, that sounds funny, but kind of as a public service, they don't blend because they try to overcompensate for that small tenor section. And so they just belt it out. Or maybe they're that first soprano, the only one that can hit that super high note. And so they're just going to minister to the world and make sure that that one high note gets out. Or the alto, you know, she might be that only alto that reads well. And so she wants to sing out super strong so that other altos can follow along. You know, most of the time this comes from a really good place in their heart. They want to help out, and we have to teach them that not only is this just not blending, but it's actually incorrect choral singing. A number of years ago, I was on church staff and we had one soprano who, no lie, sang everything one octave higher than anybody else in the whole sanctuary during our congregational singing. And as you can imagine, it was very distracting. It was humorous. It just pulled all the focus off of worshiping and onto, oh my goodness, what is going on in the choir loft? And so our music minister was so good at handling situations like this. And so privately, he had a conversation with her and said, you know, that's fantastic that God has given you those notes, but, you know, in these situations, we really need to sing the notes that are on the page and down in the same octave as everyone else. And she wrote back and said, well, you know, I have the ministry of high notes, and that she felt like the music minister was taking away her ministry of high notes. So, all of that to say that we really need to train our choirs to blend, not just so that we sound better, but it's actually a point of being correct or incorrect in a choir. There's an exercise that you can do to help with blend in your choir. Choose someone who's fairly confident, who has a blendable quality to his or her voice, and put them on an easy note with an easy syllable, maybe a G on a la or something like that, and have her just hold that la. And then you add in this voice and this voice, and you tell them, okay, I want you to match exactly in three areas. They're gonna match in volume, they're gonna match in vibrato, and they're gonna match in vowel sound, okay? So once you get those three voices then on a perfect unison blend, then you add this voice and this voice and this voice, and you make sure that they get that perfect blend as well. While everyone is holding that law, of course, breathing when they need to. And there are going to be times when you need to correct and say, okay, I hear a little bit of vibrato popping out. The vowel is not quite the same there. Okay, let's just, okay, now we're gonna add those three voices back there. And we do this until the whole choir is in a perfect blend, and it's a beautiful thing. What happens is that not only are they listening, which is crucial to blend, but as they're adjusting physically, they feel the muscles changing, and that's an important thing. So at the end of this exercise, you say, okay, pull out anthem such and such, and let's rehearse. They're gonna jump in and sing it with the same bad blend that they sang it before, but that's okay, because then you say, stop just a minute, remember how you listened and remember how that felt here. Now apply that to this song. And they'll sing it beautifully and blended for about a page and a half, and then their blend will start to unravel, and that's okay. This is a teaching moment. And you say, oh, let's stop. Do you hear that? We're going back to the same way that we sang it before. Go back to your blend. And after a couple weeks, maybe a month or two of this, you will have built a habit of blend, but it will not happen if you as the director do not enforce it. Number six, help your choir internalize the message. When you introduce a new piece of music, or in my instance, when I walk into a church choir rehearsal as the guest conductor, you know, by this time it's not a new piece of music to them, but I'll say, okay, I want to take a minute here. I want you to read through the text. And at the end of that minute, when I tell you, turn to the neighbor on each side of you, and I want you to tell them what phrase you have picked that resonates with you the most, and then tell them why. And this ends up being a beautiful thing, because not only does it force us to really, really study the text, but we also, by choosing one phrase that resonates with us, we internalize that. When we share with the other members of the choir what our phrase is and why it's important to us, we are building community and we are building bonds. You're going to have some people in your choir who would never get up in front of the whole choir and say, there's this thing going on in my life that really hurts. But when you give them that opportunity to share a phrase that resonates with them, they will say that to the person sitting on either side of them. And the beautiful thing is that when you go to rehearse this song, not only are you singing your own special phrase, but you're singing your neighbor's phrases for them. And it's almost like you're lifting them up and encouraging them by singing their phrase with them and for them. Number seven, consider taking 5 minutes of each rehearsal to give a practical music theory lesson that applies to the music that you are rehearsing. I have found that most church choirs are untrained. Most of the members don't know how to read music. This doesn't take away from their worship at all. It does take away from the rehearsal time. You know, it takes you at least 3, maybe 4 times longer to teach them the music than if they knew how to read. And wouldn't it be nice to spend that time on something else, on becoming a better musician, a better communicator, on learning different repertoire for different areas of ministry? I taught to all levels of elementary music for 4 years at a little private school in Dallas a long time ago. So I taught 2 classes of K-3. I taught 3 different classes of K-4. I taught 2 classes of K-5 and then a first grade class, a second grade, third grade, fourth, sixth grade, you know. So every week I was teaching 9 different levels of music theory to all of these different age groups, all within 1 week. By the end of the year, my kindergartners were reading high school level rhythms. They were reading whole notes and half notes and quarter notes and dotted rhythms and eighth rhythms, the eighth and 16th patterns. People were amazed. But people learn what you expect them to learn. I had a plan in place. I was consistent. And I reviewed regularly. And that, I think, is the key. You have a plan. You're consistent. You review. Your choirs can do this. I taught a couple basic music elements. The things that you want to focus on are rhythms, note reading, and then dynamics. Those are the things that they're going to use the most. Don't worry about getting into the circle of fifths. Don't worry about getting into modes. You're not going to use that much in a choir. So focus on the few basic music theory elements that are going to be the most practical. Then have a plan, be consistent, review, and then build on that. And you might think you don't have time for this. I understand. I know how limited rehearsal time is. I do. But in the long run, you know, at the beginning, it might be a sacrifice, but in the long run, it will save you so much time at the end. Think about if you never do it, you will be in the exact same spot 5 years from now that you are right now. I'm at the point in my career and in my ministry where I'm going back to repeat churches now. Churches had me in 5 or 6 years ago, and you know, now they've invited me back. They've gone through the rotation, or maybe this is my third time back with them. And there are two categories of church choirs I've noticed. When I go back to work with the choirs, there are some choirs who are the exact same choir as 5 years ago. Or 10 years ago. And then there are other church choirs where I go back and visit them for a second or a third time, and they have grown. They are better singers, they're better musicians, they're better communicators, they are a better choral unit. So just by taking 5 minutes out of every rehearsal and working on music theory, I think that we can go far with our choirs. My final point today goes hand in hand with that last point that I brought up. Church choirs do something that no other choir that I've seen does. Church choirs learn the correct notes and the correct rhythms, and they call it a success. And if they're feeling really successful that day, they might even add in dynamics. We need to get it in our brains and in our minds and in our practices that those are just the bare bones. We need to hold our choirs to a better standard of musicianship. We need to teach them that we use a different voice on different songs. We need to teach them that as we're singing, some syllables get emphasized and then some syllables get de-emphasized. We need to teach them when and how to use vibrato. I read something once that said, putting vibrato on every note is kind of like putting ketchup on every bite. After a while, it all just kind of tastes the same and it all kind of just sounds the same. So there are a lot of things that we can be doing to become better musicians and better choirs. Don't just focus on notes and rhythms and call it a success. I want to leave you today with my favorite scripture about music. 2 Chronicles 5:11-14. And you might be surprised that there's a gem in Chronicles, because Chronicles can be pretty dry, but this is a gem. It says, "And when the priest came out of the holy place, for all the priests who were present had consecrated themselves," which I'm going to point out that they realized that this was for a holy purpose, "without regard to their divisions, and all the Levitical singers, Asaph, Heman, Jeduthun," which are awesome names, by the way, we should name our children that, "their sons and their kinsmen, they were arrayed in fine linen with cymbals, harps, and lyres." That was the band. "They stood east of the altar with 120 priests who were trumpeters." And I just have to pause there. First of all, you have 120 priests, ministers, pastors who were trained musicians, and that's pretty awesome. Also, you have 120 priests who were trumpeters. Okay, so in the last church that I served at, we had two trumpeters. They outblew on carpet the whole orchestra, the whole choir, the piano, the organ, the congregation, like I said, on carpet. So here you've got 120 priests who were trumpeters. And it was the duty of the trumpeters and the singers, it was the duty of the choir and the orchestra to make themselves heard in unison in praise and thanksgiving to the Lord. And when the song was raised, you need to remember that, when the song was raised with the trumpets and the cymbals and the other musical instruments, with the band and the orchestra and the choir in praise to the Lord, and then it tells you the anthem that the choir sang here, "For he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever." Then the house of the Lord, was filled with a cloud so that the priests could not even stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of God. The first time I read through that passage, probably the first 10 times I read through that passage, I think I got goosebumps. I still do sometimes. It wasn't when the sermon was preached. It wasn't during communion. They didn't have communion back then. It wasn't during the offering or the testimony time or the altar call. It was when the choir and the orchestra came together on the anthem in unison and worshiped through music that the Spirit of God came down so thick that they had to stop church. You know, there were so many times when I was reading this that I thought, oh, wow. I so wish that would happen in our music services today and in our worship times. Wouldn't that be cool? We almost wouldn't know what to do with that. So 10 years ago, it was almost 10 years ago, I was on staff at a church. I was sitting in my church office and the phone rang. I never answered my church phone because the extension that was assigned to me was 214. If you know anything about Dallas area codes, you know that the main Dallas area code is 214. So I'm not sure what bright light assigned that to me. But anyways, that was my extension. And so all day, every day, this was a large ministry, all day, every day, everyone in the ministry was dialing my extension because they forgot to dial 9 to call out. And so I just learned to never answer my phone. People who needed to get in touch with me knew how to get in touch with me, so no big deal. But my phone rang on this particular day, and for some reason, I guess it was God, I actually picked up my phone. And the voice on the other end said, "Heather, we've never met, you don't know me, but I want to tell you a story about our choir." I thought, oh, okay, well, this should be good. And he said, "We introduced one of your new anthems a couple weeks ago, and at the end of the anthem, typically the choir kind of tiptoes off silently while the senior minister gets up and starts the sermon. That way there's no dead time." He said, "But at the end of the anthem, you know, the choir obviously was not moving, and I could tell that the senior minister was not starting his sermon. And so I thought, oh no, you know, I messed up. Was I supposed to lead another hymn? Maybe I was supposed to give another announcement." So I turned around to face the congregation, and he said, to my surprise, the whole congregation during the anthem had risen to their feet in worship and in reverence for God. And he said, the presence of God and the presence of the Holy Spirit was almost tangible. He said, I looked over in the congregation and I saw elderly people with tears pouring down their faces. And I looked over at the youth section, and there were teenagers who had tears in their eyes. And I looked over at the senior minister, who's not an emotive person. He's not emotional. He doesn't wear his heart on his sleeve. And he was weeping. He said, we stood there in a holy hush for many minutes. After many minutes, the senior pastor regained his composure and came and delivered the sermon. At the end of the sermon, the minister said, I'm going to do something I have never done before, and I'm going to ask the choir to come back up and sing this anthem. Well, this was a Presbyterian church, and they didn't have their robes on, and that might have been a big deal, I don't know, but they all filed back up, and they sang the anthem again. And the man on the other end of the phone, who has ended up turning into one of my very dearest friends, he said, Heather, the same thing happened. I turned around, and during the anthem, the whole congregation had risen to their feet in worship and awe. And we just stood there in silence while the presence of God was so thick. He said, in all of my years of ministry, I have never experienced anything like that before, and I just wanted to tell you. So I'm telling you this today because I want to let you know and to remind you that what you do matters. For some reason, musicians have been given a gift that God allows to move his heart and to move his hand and to move his spirit. This is why we take our ministry seriously. This is why we spend 75 to 80 hours a year rehearsing. This is why we pick up that mantle of professionalism and wear it in rehearsals. This is why we have our pencils in hand and we mark our scores before the director even says it, because we move the heart of God. And if no one in our congregation responds to our music, we sing for the King. Every Sunday is a concert for the King. And as a musician, this is our absolute highest calling. There's nothing we can do as a musician that is more important than that. I hope I haven't been too preachy, y'all. I have generations of preachers behind me in my family, and I just can't help it. I have so much preacher in me. Our time is just about out for this session, and so I wanted to close out by introducing a new anthem that was just released this past spring. Not One Falls is the title, and this is a special anthem to me because 100% of the royalties from this anthem goes directly to the Grace Center Texas. The Grace Center Texas is a new nonprofit that ministers to the homeless and the destitute in my own city, in the Dallas area. The Grace Center Texas meets the physical needs of the people in the community, and then they point them to Jesus. So here is the premiere performance of this anthem from a concert back in February.
Child calls that the Father.
Thank you for watching this session. I am so honored that we shared this time today. If you have any questions, you can contact me through my website, heathersorensen.com. You can also go to my YouTube channel, which is Heather Sorensen Music. God bless you and your ministries.